our bus that day. Just then, President Bush comes up on the network. Vice President Cheney, now moving past Flight 93, tells the President, "Mr. President, we just got word the South Tower of the World Trade Center has just collapsed." I'll never forget this moment, because what people were seeing was not what they were able to comprehend. They were literally telling the Vice President, "Sir, that's not true. Maybe we lost 20 floors, 30 floors. Maybe the antenna broke off. There's no way a 110-story building could be on the ground in a city of 6 million. The Vice President waved his hand and goes, "Everybody stop. Does anyone know how many people work there?" Someone yelled out, "Mr. Vice President, 7 buildings in the World Trade Center complex, 50,000 people in those two buildings alone." And he said, "Get me the President," and started to scribble. And when President Bush came up on the network, he told them we had 20,000 dead Americans in the city of New York. "Mr. President, while I got you on the phone, I was just told a portion of the Pentagon has just collapsed as a result of the impact of Flight 77. I don't have accurate figures, but it's my best guess we have 800 to 1,000 dead over at the Pentagon." He finally took the President off the speaker box, turned his back to all of us, and they had a private conversation. But then my phone started ringing off the hook again. And this time it was the United States Secret Service calling into the bunker complex to tell me they were tracking another unidentified aircraft. This time it was 8 miles out, low and fast, inbound to the White House. You know, when we don't know what it is, we call it a bogey. If we identify you as being a hostile, we'll call you a bandit. They said we have a bogey 8 miles out, low and fast, 7 miles, headed for the White House. I turned, "Mr. Vice President, sir, we got a bogey 6 miles out, low and fast, inbound to the White House." He turned 3 speaker boxes. "Donald Rumsfeld is in the Pentagon. Don, we got a bogey 5 miles out heading towards us. Do I have an asset that can take a shot at this guy? Do I have an F-15, an F-16, an F-18, anything over Washington, D.C. I can engage him with? In the meantime, we're going, Mr. Vice President, 4, 3. He goes, "Don, I'll authorize an over-the-horizon shot. No visual confirmation required. If you can lock onto him with a radar-guided missile over Baltimore, shoot him. Shoot him. Shoot him." "Mr. Vice President, 3, 2. He waved his hand in front of my face. He said, "Stop counting. If the Secret Service can't deal with it on the roof, everybody stand by for impact." I remember putting my hands on the console in front of me going, "The United States just said checkmate. We don't have a fighter aircraft over Washington, D.C. We're going to take a body blow right here at the White House. There are hundreds of people being pushed to the south and cleared to the north." And yet, just then, all the loudspeakers blared to life, "That's not a bogey. That's a medevac helicopter heading to the Pentagon to save lives." Just south of Washington, D.C., we got a great Army base called Fort Belvoir. They heard there was burn victims at the Pentagon. 6 Army doctors commandeered an HH-60 helicopter and an air crew and said, "Get us to the Pentagon." When you get 5 miles south of Washington, D.C., you call Reagan National Airport for permission to enter the airspace. Reagan National had evacuated with a flyover of Flight 77. Nobody answered them back. These brave Americans did one turn in holding, and as an air crew and a cadre of doctors, they decided we can go low and fast. We got to get to the Pentagon. There's lives that need to be saved, and we're the people who can help do it. And those pilots said, "Roger that," and they went as low and as fast as they could. The Secret Service picked them up on their sensors, and now we were doing our very best to try to kill them. We just didn't have a fighter aircraft over Washington, D.C., or we would have had another tragedy on our hands. We would have called it fog of war. Instead, thank God, it worked out for us that day. Those doctors got to the Pentagon, saved many, many lives. As a result of that, however, Vice President Cheney, first time I saw him visibly concerned over the lack of control over the airspace of the United States, turned to Norman Mineta, our Secretary of Transportation, and said, "Norm, that was a close one. I can't do that again. I want every airplane coast to coast, on the ground, do it now. I don't mean ground stops in Boston, New York, and L.A. I mean every aircraft over the United States on the ground." Norman Manez said, aye, aye, sir, picked up the phone, he called the Herndon, Virginia Command Center, and he ordered the FAA to get every non-military aircraft out of the sky, first time in history. There were 2,000-plus airliners still airborne. The FAA immediately came back, said, Mr. Secretary, we are not manned to sequence 2,000 aircraft simultaneously and land them at strange airports around our country. And as soon as they admitted that, on all the military frequencies, we heard, this is NORAD, the North American Aero Defense Command. We are assuming airspace control over the United States. If you are not a military aircraft, you are no longer authorized to be in the skies over America. Land immediately, land immediately, land immediately. For the first time in history, NORAD is now in charge. The FAA became a subordinate agency in support of the United States Air Force to help clear our skies of over 2,000 aircraft simultaneously. And guess what? We got them all down. We didn't run off one runway, clip one wing. We didn't lose a patient to a diabetic coma. At any given hour in the United States, we have 100 medevac flights in progress. Think about it, snake bite victims, car accidents, organs going A to B. If you were to order that helicopter in a farmer's field, that patient dies. But through the coordination of FAA and NORAD, we gave every one of them a military call sign and transponder code, and every one of them made it to where they needed to be to save a life. It was an incredible feat between our air traffic controllers, our United States military, and the Federal Aviation Administration to land every aircraft that day without incident. Again, first time in American history. Very proud moment just then. But the day got busy. All of a sudden we learned we have a bomb that went off on Capitol Hill and an explosion over at the U.S. State Department. We potentially don't have an air threat in the Northeast Quadrant. We have an air-ground threat. Immediately, Vice President Cheney turns to Dr. Rice, goes, Condi, figure it out. She called the Capitol Hill police. They said, ma'am, we're doing an orderly evacuation. No explosion here. She called over to the State Department. They said, yes, ma'am, we've had an event. She's got her thumb up to the Vice President. We got an event in the State Department. He goes, I need to know more. What is it? What's it look like? What do you got? And they came back and said, ma'am, not a car bomb. Our backup generator exploded when we turned it on. Again, adding to the confusion of a day, but thank God it wasn't a hostile act. It got really serious now at 10:20 when the Secret Service called down again. Major, we got a credible source against the Sarasota, Florida. In the Sarasota, Florida area, that Angel is the next target. For those of you who don't know, Angel's the Secret Service code word for the president on board Air Force One. Someone used that code word in the conversation. It got elevated to the highest levels of our government. Who would know the code word and why would they put it in that threat? Do we have a rogue Secret Service agent? Do we have a rogue White House press corps member? Is the president on danger on Air Force One? We really didn't know. The vice president called Colonel Mark Tillman, the Air Force One pilot, told him to take evasive maneuvers. They put the president in the nose of the aircraft, the White House press corps back in your seats. No one's allowed to transmit or receive information. Air traffic control, you're no longer allowed to report the position of Air Force One. We call it a complete communications blackout. Colonel Tillman pulled that aircraft back, put those four engines to max power. They went to 50,000 feet heading west at almost 700 miles an hour. They end up scrambling two F-16s at the Ellington Air National Guard Base in Houston, Texas. Told them to get to 50,000 feet. You'll figure it out when you get up there. Another little bit of irony, President Bush served in the Texas Air National Guard. That was the unit he was serving with that was just scrambled to protect him. He literally has his squadron mates on either side of him that day, escorting him safely to the west. 10 minutes after Vice President Cheney said clear the skies, he gave the United States military the authorization to shoot down any aircraft not complying with their landing instructions anywhere near the Washington, D.C. area. Immediately, the Pentagon came back and said, Roger that, sir, copy all. And by the way, we got a Navy DDG, a guided missile destroyer off the coast of New York, tracking 60 targets. 60 airliners told to land for the very last time in Newark, LaGuardia, or JFK Airport. He said, Roger that, I want a missile solution for every one of them. it was truly Vice President Cheney in charge, taking our country back from terrorists. Here's a moment I always tell everybody is when our president got his sea legs. President Bush came from Texas. He's been our president for 8 months. He's now on Air Force One. Cheney's been making some of the hard calls, and now the president basically assumes command. He's always been the commander-in-chief, but now he's totally leaning forward when he calls for an air threat conference. An air threat conference is, I want every cabinet-level secretary to get to their Iridium phone, dial into Air Force One, tell me what's happening in your area of responsibility, and what are you doing about it. I'll never forget this moment because they're all on the phone, they're talking to the president. It came around to the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld. He goes, Mr. President, I recommend we take our nuclear weapons from DEFCON 4, Defense Condition 4, up to Defense Condition 3, DEFCON 3. Five is peace. One is imminent nuclear war. We're worldwide DEFCON 4, and he wants to go to DEFCON 3. President said, you know what? Great idea. Have him stand by for DEFCON 2. Dr. Rice, sitting next to me, wanted to remind me that we haven't been to DEFCON 2 since the Cuban Missile Crisis back in 1962, when Cheney interrupted her and said, Condi, make it happen. She picked up the red phone on my console, called over to the National Military Command Center. They, in turn, call out to Cheyenne Mountain, Colorado, home of NORAD. They button up the mountain for the first time in anger, and that four-star Air Force commander now calls our four-star commanders around the world. And we're listening in at this very moment to hear, this is Pacific Command, Atlantic Command, European Command, Central Command, Southern Command, Joint Forces Command, Special Operations Command. This is NORAD. We are DEFCON 3, standing by DEFCON 2. A pivotal moment in history. We went from taking body blows to now being a nuclear military superpower. We're going to war. We just don't know who we're going to war with yet. Just then the phone rings, I pick it up and they go, Major, we got President Putin holding for the President of the United States. Will you take the call? You know, my first reaction was, no. Tell Putin I'm here to do logistics. But I snapped out of it. I turned, Mr. Vice President, sir, I got President Putin holding for the President of the United States. Sir, will you take the call? And like the great leader he was, he goes, hey, Condi, you take the call. I wrote down in my notebook that day that leadership equals delegation. When you're top of the food chain, you can give it away. Dr. Rice, now sitting next to me, talking to President Putin of Russia, thanking him for his phone call, telling him our president's in motion. We don't know the size and scope of the attack. Our president's going to call you the first chance he gets. And by the way, Mr. President, thank you for standing down your nuclear forces. Apparently, according to the START Treaty, when we go DEFCON 3, we call Russia, and they go DEFCON 3. 2-2 and 1-1. It's fair if the missiles pass each other. It's just not fair for those of us that want to live on this planet. Russia stayed at their DEFCON 4, while America went worldwide DEFCON 3. Saddest moment in history, we lost the North Tower. President on the network. Vice President Cheney tells him we have 40,000 dead Americans in the city of New York. He said, what about Mayor Giuliani? Anybody speak to the mayor? No phone call with the mayor. What about hospitals? What are they saying? He goes, I got no reports from any hospitals. He goes, Dick, what about FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency? He goes, Mr. President, FEMA hasn't even left yet. An hour and 45 minutes after the attack on America began, it takes a lot longer to get everybody over to Andrews, flown up to John F. Kennedy, escorted into Manhattan Island. It was a sad moment. 315 million Americans counting on our commander-in-chief. We had no good options for the president. Very sad moment in American history. Just then, as a result of DEFCON 3, we got all the principals into their hardened facilities. America now is prepared to defend democracy, make sure our government continues to function. Our leadership is where it needs to be. I want to fast forward. You know, our president went to Barksdale, Louisiana that day. That's where they chose to take him. Why did he go there? Because he wanted to talk to the American public. He wanted the world to see that he was alive and well and in command. That no matter what happens and what these terrorists do, what any adversary of ours tries to do, our presidency will survive. our form of government will always thrive. Three branches of government are now in their hardened facilities, and our leadership is right there on the TV to tell America that he's in charge, he's coming home, he's going to defend democracy. Well, they decided to take him to Offutt, Nebraska, and from Offutt, Nebraska, at 6:30 p.m., he landed on the White House lawn, escorted into the bunker complex by Dr. Rice. He received an updated presidential daily brief. I'll share with you, it was in that brief that we told the president it was Osama bin Laden in an al-Qaeda camp in Afghanistan, and here, Mr. President, are your options for response. Though those options are something we're not going to talk about in detail, I will tell you, we could either do a tomahawk-type strike, or option B is 300,000 troops halfway around the world to defend America. President Bush was automatically gone to option two. We're not doing it. We're not putting missiles in the sky so they can warn al-Qaeda and bin Laden that those missiles are inbound and he can escape once again. He said, we're going around the world. We're going to do it the old-fashioned way, boots on the ground. American might and military power is going to be shown worldwide. You're either against us or you're with us in this war on terror, that this attack on our nation will not go unpunished, and we're going to send our best and brightest halfway around to make sure that you understand it. And for the last 20 years, that's what we've been doing. And the world is on notice. America still stands. America is still free. America is still thriving and functioning as the beacon of light. There aren't Americans that want to leave. There's only people that want to come here for very good reason. We are the greatest nation on earth. The president briefed the American public at 8:30 that night from the Oval Office, and they took him upstairs. He went to bed at 10:30. And that was the end of his day. I want you to know I put this picture up there because I escorted a small group of White House staffers to Ground Zero. They took a firefighter off the pile and he came down to tell us what he saw out there, what we can expect. And I'll never forget what he said. This first responder said, I know it's been 3 weeks since the attack on our country, but it's still a rescue mission in my heart and my mind. It's not a recovery mission. Bucket by bucket, we're looking for somebody who maybe found a water source who might still be alive. They said there's 13 stories of carnage. There are no desk, escalators, or elevators. At 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, everything eviscerates into ash, glass, and twisted steel. Beams so large, if you and I held hands, we couldn't get our arms around them, that were ripped, melted, and torn like paper. Blocks away from Ground Zero, sticking straight through the road, were water mains. All that plumbing that came down with two 110-story buildings had to go somewhere, and under the street, some of those pipes broke loose and came right through the street. Try to imagine 750,000 people running for their very lives and a water main come through the road right next to them. It must have been truly Armageddon. There's a picture of the hole in the ground, shocked first responders and people. But this is a real special quote from our commander-in-chief in front of a joint session of Congress addressing every American in our nation when he said, I will not forget the wound to our country and those who inflicted it. I will not yield. I will not rest. I will not relent in waging this struggle for freedom and for the security for the American people, President George W. Bush. And I want to tell you now, 20 years later, these patriots who are here with us, these patriots on the stage, 20 years now, they've been going into hostile territory to defend America, to make sure hostile intent doesn't come to our shores once again. They carried the burden of this. I think the colonel said it best when they've been defending freedom on all fronts in all four corners of the globe. They have defended our way of life so we could come and have an event like this tonight. We are going to remember the 2,977. We're going to honor the 30,000 that we lost in combat or non-combat operations. And they're counting on us to reinvigorate our spirit as Americans, to not become demoralized, not become so politically blinded that you lose the fact that we're the greatest nation on earth. We are so super strong and ready to fight wherever our leaders tell us to go and do that mission. These young men and women are proof of that. These communities like yours who invite people like me to come speak are proof of that. Remembrance and reinvigoration is what we want to do today. We want to recommit ourselves to the ideals of our great nation and carry this legacy forward for the next generation. Never lose sight, the United States of America is truly the beacon of light. In closing tonight, I want to tell each and every one of you, thank you. Thank you for your participation. Thank you for what you do in your communities. Thank you for supporting these national heroes of ours, your first responders, law enforcement, medical service personnel. Thank you for what you do for America. Like I said, Kansas, the United States, and ultimately our great nation. God bless each and every one of you. God bless Manhattan, Kansas, and God bless the United States of America. Thank you all very, very, very much. Thank you. Thank you all very much. God bless.